Life support is nominal. The oxygen danger indicator level is yellow. Please remember that this is a non-smoking pirate ship.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to GameIndustry.com's The Gin Lounge. I'm John Breeden, your chief lounge lizard, and your host for this episode of the show. This week, we've got a special show for you because we're going to be diving into the Supreme Ruler Ultimate game and talking about how to conquer the world. And joining me is George Gatesy. He is the co-founder of Battle Goat Studios and also the lead programmer on the game. George, welcome to the show
today. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Oh, absolutely. We're really glad to have you here with us today. I know that a lot of our readers love the Supreme Ruler games and just big fans of Battle Goat in general. So you are the co-founder of Battle Goat. How long has Battle Goat been around? You guys have been around for about I'm thinking what we started around what like 2000 something like that.
That's right. The company was formed in February of 2000, and even the goal was to take a game that had actually been even a longer history than that, because the original Supreme Ruler was a text-based game that I myself wrote for the TRS-80 microcomputer, you know, before the IBM PC became dominant, and the idea was to take that text-based game, the concept of it, and to bring it forward to a modern platform, and so we created Battle Goat in 2000 to do that.
Oh well, I didn't know that. So it was the original text game. Was it how did it present you with like situations like, you know, Russia's invading the Ukraine? What do you want to do about it? Type of thing. Or
I wish we had that much flexibility in 48K of memory, but things were a little more restricted back then. But the concept of the game was a fictional world with up to 9 countries existed, and your goal was to run one of the countries. You would basically choose how much you know, you wanted to distribute in food to your people, how much you were going to fund government services, and how much you were going to build your army up, and then, of course, attack the other countries trying to take over this miniature existence and become the supreme ruler nation of the world.
Oh, I'm a big fan of the classic games, and I am sorry I did not know about that one, but I'm definitely going to look it up.
Yeah, you can pull up a TRS-80 emulator and play it on your modern machine, but not too many people actually have TRS-80s anymore to play the original.
No, mine died a long time ago, unfortunately. Good little system for the time. So Supreme Ruler, it's an interesting series. It started out with sort of a World War II focus, right? And is that how what you intended to start from there and then incorporate the more modern elements, or was that just was that just something that happened, or was that sort of the original plan for the series?
It actually started a bit the other way around. That our very first version of it was Supreme Ruler 2010. So this is the game that we started making in 2000. 10 years into the future, a distant future game. So the concept was to create something that was based on the real world. The countries and the situations people are sort of familiar with, the military equipment, but to create a storyline that would put the world into chaos. So the world is in crisis, and countries are, their relationships are deteriorating, and oil is a commodity that's becoming more rare, and there's more chance of countries getting into fights over various resources. So the idea was to tie a storyline into the near future, but use data from the existing world. So people would be able to fly F-14 interceptors and M1 tanks and against the Russian T-72s, and so you get the ability to recreate what if scenarios based on the world of today, but with a more crisis oriented storyline. So we started on that in 2000, and finally released the Supreme Ruler 2010 in 2005.
Yeah, I think I got the T-shirt for that. I think it was like dictators get all the chicks or something.
Maybe we could have gone with that, but no, that wasn't our line.
Oh, okay. Well, so when did the series move into World War II? Was that was the last reiteration of
That's
it?
That's right. I mean the sort of thumbnail synopsis of the series after 2010, we actually. had a lot of things we still wanted to do that the engine wasn't really capable of doing. So we actually went back a bit to the drawing board, revamped the engine with a lot of improvements to make it support a lot of features that we couldn't do the first time. So, and then we released another version of the near future game, Supreme Ruler 2020, which was released in 2008. It was after that that we started going back in time, because then we did the Cold War game as our next iteration, and then finally the World War II game, Supreme Ruler 1936.
Great. Well, talking about the historical games, the Cold War game and the World War II game. Obviously, you guys know, because I'm sure you as an independent studio, you probably hear a lot from your users. You probably have a fairly passionate user base.
Yeah.
one of good and bad, you know. I'm sure they let you know about it. But one of the things that a lot of the people that play these type of games are really into is the historical accuracy. Obviously, they want things to be right. So how did you come up with doing – I mean, how long did it take to do the research and to get things accurate for the Cold War game and the World War II game?
Well, quite a bit. A lot of our development effort was focused onto the research. And you're right, the users – I mean, we've had some people playing our game since the beta of 2010. So, I mean, these are people who have played our game now, our game series now for over 10 years. And they give us great feedback. And some of them have – an inclination towards one region or another. So you get the players who really like playing Soviets and Russians, and you have players who like the U.S., and you have players who are like European countries. And you know, if you get something wrong, you know, you misspell the name of a city, or you put it in the wrong place by a few hexes, and we hear about that. So the combination of the research that we did and the feedback of our users is really made the game very strong from the historical standpoint. But the initial work was, pulling out the atlas and drawing, working with our map editor and other tools that allowed us to recreate the world on a basis of, 16 kilometer hexes one at a time, basically.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. And what about the military units and stuff? How did you research, what units, Germany had available to it in 1939 or whatever versus what's in the game? I assume it's fairly accurate as far as starting positions in the different countries and so forth.
Yeah, definitely, and that's obviously another area where a lot of research was involved. For the units, we've actually had some great assistance with both not just our user community, but also we've worked with some specialists. We have some people, ex-military people and people who have advised the U.S. military on various topics that have helped us to look at our units, our equipment balance, our unit balance, and so on. And we have a couple of bookshelves full of books downstairs about the units in the Soviet era and units in World War II and the equipment, this and that. It's also amusing that a lot of our resources, once you get enough resources, they start to conflict with each other. And so you also find out that sometimes, if you get it wrong, you can always say, well, nobody was really sure. but in general, we have to at least have some good justification if we pull that line out, because there is a lot of documentation from the era. So we do strive to get the accuracy of our details as high as possible.
Yeah, and one of the things I think that people love about your games, and we'll get into the newest one, Supreme Ruler Ultimate, but in general, in all the different games in the series, is being able to play, like you were saying, you have some fans that are like the Soviet era, and some people like to play the U.S. and so forth. We have one guy here at Gin who does a lot of the reviews. He's Serbian, so he always likes to go, pick like Albania or something and try to play the game as some like small country, and you guys enable him to do that more often than not. I mean, he's able to pick a country that he likes and play it and play a very different game than somebody who's, playing like the Soviet Union or something like that. I mean, how does one go about, I mean, you're the lead programmer. I mean, how does one go about creating a game that has so many starting points? I mean, essentially you're creating an open world sandbox that allows you to to play as anyone and see the world from different perspectives. That must be an incredibly detailed effort.
Well, definitely. And one of the things about the game that it takes a little bit of getting used to for people who might come from a certain other types of strategy games is there is no sense of balance that, you know, the red team equals the blue team. I mean, because these countries are based on historical data, you know, they'll have strengths and weaknesses. You know, right now, if you play, you know, the modern world, well, obviously the U.S. is by far the single strongest entity, so there isn't any one-to-one competition on it, but then you can start playing what-ifs, you know, of what if everybody ganged up on the U.S.? Would they be strong enough to hold them off? Yeah, when you go back and look at a historical thing, you know, if you start playing as, a small region in Africa, well, your goal is not immediately to take over the world. Obviously, the first goal might be to, you know, unite Africa under a single rule. And then if you do that, you know, can you build it up into being a superpower and then take on the world? So these sort of what-if scenarios present themselves. But you're right, yeah, I mean, the fact that the engine supports running a big country and it also supports you playing from the smallest guy on the map, it does present some challenges from the user interface and the player standpoint, but I think it overall creates such a huge amount of replayability and so many options for how players can take on the game.
Yeah, absolutely, and not just it's not just impressive from the players being able to play in everything, but on the back end, your game has to be able to have all the other countries that you're not playing also react intelligently and have their own agenda and so forth. So how much time goes into, I guess, planning out, okay, so I'm playing, you know, Serbia or something, or a region in Africa. I mean, how much time goes into, you know, planning out what the United States and what the Soviet Union are doing, which may not even really affect you during that game, but all those countries are still off doing their own things, right?
Oh, yeah, and then, well, actually, one of the technical details that I love about our engine that really doesn't, you know, show much for the average player, but the fact is that everything is running in the background, and in fact, the AI doesn't cheat at all. So what we do is we use multi-threading, so each country gets a sort of AI thread that's a separate thread, so if you have a modern processor with a lot of cores, all of that gets spread out amongst the multiple processors, but each AI, you know, thinks independently, and the communications between AIs is the same type of thing that was, you know, would happen, communication between AI and player. So, you know, they can do diplomatic offers, they can, you know, reject, they can ally with each other, but all of that is done using the same code that they would evaluate a offer from another human player, or you know, multiple human players if you're playing multiplayer. So all of this code is running as a layer, and the AI itself, each country gets an independent AI that, you know, looks at its own situation and reviews what's going on.
Wow, that I did not know that. That is pretty exciting. So the AI that's playing the Soviet Union isn't going to make a specific move because it knows that Hungary is going to attack, you know, so it's somebody, one of its neighbors, so it's going to make a counter move. It doesn't know that until after that event happens, and it will react, but it won't preempt and do something, you know, having knowledge that a player wouldn't necessarily have.
Exactly. If AIs are allies with each other, they'll share information, such as, you know, one AI will identify to another one that, hey, I'm going to attack you know, Germany in July, are you, you know, joining? And then the, you know, AI number two can decide to come along or not. But as far as, you know, Germany, you know, it's AI won't know anything happened until the attack is actually declared.
Wow, very, very interesting. That's pretty neat. I know a lot of the games that have these strategy components, they kind of fall apart, some of them, because of the diplomacy. So, I mean, that seems to be a pretty good secret that you guys got about, you know, making diplomacy seem realistic. And then how do you go about like evaluating what the in terms of diplomacy and also in terms of decisions, like what does a typical country, you know, what kind of thought process is behind the AI, whether it accepts your offer or not, and that type of thing? Is it able to weight different factors and decide what's best for it? Or
yeah, definitely. And this is also an area that gets a lot of discussion amongst our community and amongst the studio, because I mean, the AI internally has a system where it weighs dozens of factors when it considers a diplomatic offer. What your relationship is, whether it's supporting you or going against you, whether there are benefits to the things you're trying to trade. You're trying to trade, for example, a submarine technology to a landlocked region is probably not going to get much interest from it. And so the AI has to weigh all of those factors. One of the things, and the other thing that the AI has to do when dealing with humans is, of course, be suspicious because people will try to, trick the AI, which, in the end, you're looking to exploit it. But so the AI has to have this, general suspicion that an offer may not be exactly what it seems. For example, you might want, try to trade a technology to an AI that will end up increasing its efficiency, increasing its agriculture efficiency, but making agriculture more expensive. Well, if the AI has excess capacity already, then it doesn't need more expensive agriculture. So it has to have some suspicion. The problem is that also makes it a little hard to deal with the AIs at times. And, people say, well, the AIs, reacting to my offers as easily as it should. And that's because all our AIs are paranoid. So it does get some discussion about whether we should allow AIs to be tricked or allow them to be over paranoid and where the balance is. And we made it controlled by a difficulty level. You can set diplomatic difficulty manually from the other difficulties of the game, but that doesn't always keep everyone pleased.
Wow. No, that's really interesting. I mean, I imagine that, knowing what I know about, the strategic community, I imagine that would get a lot of discussion as to, whether the AI is smart or not. There are some games that the AI just rejects everything that you give to it, but then there are others that allow themselves to be tricked, like you say. It's neat that you can control the difficulty on that. Looking at the World War II version of the game, you put all the factors in place that are historically accurate. If the game is kind of just like running itself, does it often come out with the same results as far as what happened in real life? I mean, do the Allies normally win a World War II scenario if left to its own devices?
Oddly enough, usually not. And once again, this also brings us a discussion of the community, because I mean the game in particular, when you start from the 1936 sandbox, the 36 configuration is quite realistic, and in general, playing up until 40-41, things will be sort of the same. Germany will take over Poland, and France will get involved. However, sometimes the so-called phony war, where France and Germany really didn't shoot at each other for between the invasion of Poland and the Battle of France, that the AI doesn't really understand the purpose of that. So in general, the French and the Germans tend to start a fight a little sooner than that, what I find interesting is when you do run the game and you don't touch it, the game will play differently each time you play it. Sometimes France will win and defeat Germany very early, and sometimes Germany will take out France 6 months earlier than happened historically, and various other combinations seem to come around. After that, the problem is the AI, especially the AI playing Germany, really doesn't understand the reason for attacking the Soviet Union. So, we can force it to do that using scripted events, but I think the AI, given its own reasons, would not do that attack at the time Germany did it.
Well, that's interesting. So if an AI were running Germany back then, it might have fared better than historically has.
Quite possibly, yes.
Very interesting. So then, how did the most modern game in your series, the one that just came out, Supreme Ruler Ultimate, how did that come to pass? I mean, that's set in 2020. So is that basically kind of like a new version of the you know the original game, which was set in, you know, the distant future of 2010, and so is this one set in 2020 is kind of like, you know, the 10 years in the future type of scenario along those same type of lines.
Well, actually, it's a bit more than that and a bit different from that. You know, what we did with Ultimate is we actually took all of the content we had developed, you know, everything from 1936 to the Cold War to the near future games up to 2020, and combined them into one. So first of all, it has all the content in particular of 1936 and Supremular Cold War. It also brings some of the older content from our future games and brings it into the new engine. So, I mean, over the you know, since Supremular 2020 was released 6 years ago, we have done a lot of engine improvements. The game plays much faster, the AI is much smarter, and so on. So it brings that content into the modern engine, but it also puts it all together. So first of all, you can start from any of those eras. So in the one game, you can start from World War II or Cold War or the future, or you can, it has all the content so you can play through the entire sequence. So you can start in 1936, and you can, you know, if you can play right through into the Cold War, you know, you can play right through into the future. The tech tree actually goes, you know, well into the, you know, late 21st century. So you can start, you know, from researching the tanks of World War II up to researching laser mechs in the future, all in the same game.
Wow, that's pretty good. So playing a game like that, I assume that's a bit of a commitment for a player.
If you play the whole sequence, the whole, you know, the whole campaign and the right through, then it can be quite a long game. Of course, you can save and pick it up and back up. And like I say, you can also, we have a lot of options because you can play any of the eras, or you can even play a shorter scenario. So you can just hop in and play, for instance, you know, the Korean War, or you can hop in and play one of our near future hypothetical scenarios, or just you know, the Battle of France. So it gives you a lot of flexibility for the type of game you want to play. But the long campaign definitely has a following because you can, especially if you start out with a small country, you know, it gives you the time to build that up and you know, join the tech race with the big guys and try to, you know, take a small country into dominance.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. That's pretty cool. There's not a lot of games out there that offer that particular experience, so I can see certainly would certainly be happy to do that. A lot of the strategy gamers, assuming you're able to survive throughout the whole eras. Have you yourself? I mean, you're the programmer. I mean, is it fun for you to do that? Do you ever, you know, take your programmer hat off and sit down and say, I'm gonna take a small country and or even a mid-sized country like Canada or something. You know, you guys are from Canada. Do you ever want to start Canada off in World War II and take them all the way in through the future and actually just play the game?
David's done. David's one of his favorites is playing from Canada, so he's the lead designer and also the co-founder with me. And he's had the ability to do more of the long-term testing and you know, taking a country like Canada and playing it for a while. Strangely enough, I'd love to spend more time playing Supreme Ruler long-term games, but usually, you know, being the programmer, you know, I have this list of bugs that people want me to research, so I have to play whatever save game or whatever era happens to come up on the task list, and so I get a lot of short snippets of games, but the long-term ones is something I think over the Christmas break I'm going to sit back and start a few of those, but in the last couple of months, I haven't had the chance to play our game as much as I would like, which is strange when you consider it.
No, absolutely. No, I can see that. I can definitely see that. So, well, that brings up sort of on the business side of things. So you guys are an independent studio. You do it all yourselves. You're mostly just the two of you, right? I mean, that's pretty much Battle Goat is just the two guys there that are working.
We actually a little bit bigger than that. We have a core team of five, and then we also have additional people we use for contracts, such as sound and music. We also have testers on top of that, and then some of our research, the people I mentioned that help us with the research and so on. But you know, we have outside of David and myself, a great graphic artist that's done both their user interface, the 3D units, and so on. Stefan Kauris does an incredible job with the restrictions we give him. Because our game has no preset limits on the number of units or the size of the map, we simulate the entire world. So, it's telling him to do the great job with the graphics and the units, but oh yeah, your poly count limit is like 700 polys per unit. Good luck with that. So it's, he's done, managed to do a lot with the restrictions we give him. And, Chris Latour and Daxon Flynn were our game designers and so they did everything from the events and the overall design of scenarios and the campaigns and tutorials and so on. So together as a team, we've been working on it as a long-term project over the various incarnations of the franchise.
Do you guys enjoy being an independent studio? There are some studios obviously that get founded and then they get under the wing of a publisher and then. They kind of go off in a different direction. Do you like the way that that you have things set up there as an indie? Do you ever think it'd be good to become a development studio for a major publisher, or do you like the way things are going now as a pure indie?
Well, being an indie has been nice. It's been it's not how we started. We actually our first game was published through a Canadian publisher called Strategy First, and that relationship did not turn out very well at all. But after that, we managed to sign with Paradox Interactive, so the developer of Hearts of Iron in Europa and so on, and mm-hmm. and that was has been a great relationship. They published our Supremula 2020 title, they published the Cold War title, and the worldwide distribution and so on. But after the Cold War, the sands were shifting a little bit. First of all, retail stores, especially in North America, but even around the rest of the world, were no longer carrying PC titles from indies. Steam was the distribution platform, and Paradox mm-hmm. already has a World War II series. They have the Hearts of Iron series, so us creating a World War II game was also a little bit confusing from that perspective. And so in the end, we for the World War II game for Supremula 1936, we went forward as an independent. We have a great relationship with Steam, so our game is available on Steam. And going forward, it does give us a lot of flexibility. We also love the by coincidence, the early access program started up shortly before we released 1936. So that gave us an opportunity to get the game in front of people, yet still have a flow of income from the early access sales, but get not only feedback, but be able to really tune the game through the early access before its release.
Yeah, the Steam platform really has helped a lot of independent studios. It's really robust, especially with that early access. I was just looking at your Steam page. You have a lot of reviews. Most of them fall into the very positive. I think you have 85% very positive reviews on Steam, so that's amazing. So good job on that. So I guess let me ask you. So what are you guys working on now? I know you say you're playing snippets that people send you and trying to stamp out any little bugs or quirks in the Supreme Ruler Ultimate game. But is there any project that we can look forward to coming out of Battle Goat in the future or the near future?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question because. Right now we're still working on updates and continued improvements to Ultimate. In all of our past games, we've always had a history of continuing to both improve them and offer new content for months after the release and for free. And we're not changing that. We still have some plans on a couple of tweaks and additions to Ultimate that we'll be releasing over the next couple of months. Beyond that, it's Ultimate. I like its name. Ultimate is sort of the pinnacle of the franchise. I mean, the 1936, the World War II game, and then putting them together into the whole campaign that you can play over the history of World War II to the future. That has been the vision of where the series would go. And while people have requested a lot of stuff from us. For example, people have asked us to put our engine in World War One and ancient Rome or into the future into space. But there are, I think, other games are doing a very good job with some of those time frames. So it would be hard to bring a lot of new material to that those eras. And so right now there is no next Supreme Ruler on the books. The studio is actually in a bit of a in between mode, where we're continuing to support Ultimate and bring out some new content to it. We're catching up on our paperwork and so on, but but right now we actually haven't decided on the next big project that we'll be doing.
So the people who are listening today and want to check out Supreme Ruler Ultimate, where can they find you guys, and where can they get a demo or something to give this looks like an amazing game, and what our reviewer said gave it, I believe, 4.5 out of 5 stars. Great title. Where can people find it and check it out?
For some of our past games, the 2020 and the Cold War, we do have a demo version available, so people can get those. We haven't released a demo as such for 36 Ultimate, because the whole nature of the business seems to change that people now, when they are interested in getting a preview of the game, are more likely to go onto YouTube and look for a Let's Play or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we haven't had as much demand for a demo. If people want to get a feel for the game, for instance, 2020 is, I think, with some of the sales that different digital stores have over Christmas, you can pick 2020 up for $5. I'm sure that 1936 will be on sale, and even Ultimate will be on sale over the Christmas period from Steam and Gamers Gate and some of the other venues that we have. So because the price of games has gone down and YouTube is around and so on, we haven't felt as much of a need for a demo. But if people want to get a feel for what our games are like, they can certainly check out some of our previous titles, either very cheaply, or in fact 2010, there's even a link that we posted when we had the previous promotion that lets them download that for free. It might require a couple of Google searches, but it's part of when we had a Kickstarter for our one of our titles. We released a code for that people can just download the original game, though that one is a little dated by now.
Well, true, but and then is your website is battlegoat.com to check out, actually looking, you can see all the different games and the whole list that you guys have available. So definitely encourage people to do that. Well, I was looking at the box tops, you can tell the styles changed looking back at the May 2005 game, Supreme Ruler 2010. It's sort of the art is so different than the artwork that is used today. So
yeah, it cool. Has progressed a little bit, and in particular, with 2020, our engine did take a major leap forward, and then as I mentioned, with the graphic artist we brought on board has really created a nice look and feel to the game, both the user interface and so on. So it has developed over the years.
Great. Well, George, thank you so much. We appreciate your time today coming into the lounge and chatting with us about Supreme Ruler Ultimate and the whole series. And wish you the best of luck with all your future endeavors. Everybody here is really impressed with the quality of the games that you make and the size and the scope of your titles. And hope you guys continue doing it for many years to come.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, everybody. So that's our episode of the show for today. You can join us anytime at GameIndustry.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Pinterest, Google+, Twitter. We're all those places. Until next time, everyone, I hope that the country that you pick is able to take over the world, or at least survive another day. Take care, everyone. See you next time right here at the Gin Lounge. We'll be right back.